From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The War Against Terror and Civil Rights. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush still wants Congress to approve his program of wiretaps without court warrants. Democrats say, wait till next year. Everybody agrees it's essential to monitor communications between terrorist suspects. The question is, how much oversight is required to prevent abuse? On To the Point, we'll look at surveillance in Britain, where the intelligence service has stunned the public with revelations about ongoing terrorist plots. How serious is the threat in this country? Are U.S. intelligence agents hampered by too many rules? On Reporter's Notebook Letter on Al Jazeera in English. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Britain's highest intelligence officer has gone public with details of extensive surveillance of terrorist plots. President Bush wants Congress to approve his program for wiretaps without warrants. On To the Point, how serious is the threat in this country? Do U.S. agents need the freedom their British counterparts have? What about civil rights? On Reporter's Notebook, one of the world's most controversial news outlets will now be in English. We'll hear the latest on Al Jazeera. First, this news update. For the first time since Donald Rumsfeld's resignation as Secretary of Defense, America's top general in Iraq appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee today. Arizona Republican John McCain said yesterday's brazen kidnapping of workers from a government building is further evidence that more American troops are needed in Baghdad. Here's the response from General John Abizaid.
We can put in 20,000 more Americans tomorrow and achieve a temporary effect. But when you look at the overall American force pool that's available out there, the ability to sustain that commitment is simply not something that we have right now with the size of the Army and the Marine Corps. We can win with the Iraqis if we put our effort into the Iraqis as our first priority, and that's what I think we should do.
Senator McCain respectfully disagreed. Jonathan Broder is defense and foreign policy editor at Congressional Quarterly. Jonathan, always good to have you in our program.
Hey, Warren.
So the general was at odds with at least one Republican. What about the Democrats who've been calling for a phased withdrawal of American troops?
Well, obviously, it was also at odds with them. He's saying that there shouldn't be a withdrawal right now, that such a withdrawal would result in a sharp escalation in the sectarian fighting between Sunni and Shia in Iraq. And some of the members on the Senate Armed Services Committee, where Abizaid was testifying today, interpreted his view as defending the status quo, which both Democrats and Republicans were not happy with for separate reasons.
You mentioned sectarian violence. In August, General Abizaid said that it had reached a terrible level. Did he make any comparisons between what it's like now and what it was like then?
Well, he said that it wasn't as bad now as the situation in Iraq was not as bad now as it appeared in August. That's not to say that things are good now or that he said things are good. He said Anbar province was not under control. And as you mentioned, the raid, the kidnapping in Baghdad yesterday suggested that things aren't really under control in Baghdad either. But he did make the point that it was not as bad as it was in August.
Talking with Jonathan Broder at Congressional Quarterly. Well, you mentioned once again that the idea of withdrawing now was not something that the general approved of. What about the idea of the phased withdrawal and the timetable that's implied by that?
He won't really touch that right now. He doesn't want to get on a slippery slope of suggesting any kind of withdrawal. He says that they are considering all options. But if we go back to his reply to McCain, when McCain talked about that perhaps more troops were needed. What he was basically saying there was that the United States Army and Marine Corps doesn't have the extra troops to send into the battle in Iraq, and that really the only option that the United States has right now is to train up the Iraqis to have them do the job. So in other words, any extra forces would come from the Iraqis.
So that does sound like maintaining the status quo to the Democrats.
Well, yes. As you know, one thing that came out in this hearing, and of course this is, as you said, the first time that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has had these senior commanders from Iraq before the committee since the election and since Rumsfeld was let go. It gives you an indication of which way the committee is going to be looking at this war once they take over in January. The Democrats very much want a withdrawal, and they were pushing for that in their questioning of Abizaid today, while many Republicans, including McCain and Graham of South Carolina, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, were trying to press him on the whole issue of whether more U.S. troops were needed. But as I said before, Abizaid returns to the theme of training up more Iraqis to do the job, and if any more U.S. troops would be sent over, they would be trainers rather than combat troops to increase what they call the transition teams of U.S. troops and trainers that are embedded with Iraqi units.
So there are, in fact, trainers available. The general said, as we heard, that he thinks the Army and the Marine Corps are very limited, but you could increase the number of trainers?
You could, but the problem here, Warren, is that training has never had training foreign forces has never had the cachet within the Army and the Marine Corps that being a combat soldier does. When people go into the Army, they want action. They don't want to be training other people's forces. So the problem is that has never been a big priority within the U.S. Armed Forces, and they have to do that. They have to make that a priority now and make it a career advancement priority. In other words, you're not going to really get ahead in your military career unless you sign on to the training mission.
Jonathan Broder, as always, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Defense and Foreign Policy Editor for Congressional Quarterly, based, of course, in Washington. In a moment, the war on terrorism and civil rights on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. It's been less than a week since the head of Britain's intelligence service, MI5, said 1,600 people are under surveillance for 30 terrorist plots linked to al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Queen Elizabeth today presented Prime Minister Tony Blair's last program to Parliament, indicating that Blair will ask for new legislation to address this terrorist threat. Meantime, in this country, President Bush has asked Congress to approve his formerly secret program of wiretaps for terrorist suspects without court warrants. Democrats are saying wait till next year to debate what they call an illegal practice. We'll have more on that in a moment. First, let's hear how surveillance works in Britain. Neil Ellis is a Homeland Security expert at the independent Royal United Services Institute. Mr. Ellis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
Tell us, if you will, first of all, the timing of this announcement about the surveillance that's going on in Britain by the head of MI5. Does that appear to have been intended to build support for what Mr. Blair wants to see happen next?
I think that's an interesting point. It seems a particularly significant moment when the Director General of the Security Service emerges from the shadows to reveal the extent of the threat we face in the UK. But it should be seen as largely a culmination of briefings that have happened over the preceding months. We had the head of our anti-terrorism command in the UK talk about thousands of passive sympathisers that currently exist. That was followed by the Home Secretary, John Reid, a few weeks ago talking about in the region of 24 plots that are ongoing and being investigated. And finally, we have the Director General, who knows better than anyone else the extent of the threat that we face, coming up with some pretty alarming but pretty specific numbers as well, which is something that certainly hasn't been put out into the open before.
Well, let me ask you, what is the nature of surveillance that she was talking about, and very specifically, how important is wiretapping?
Well, certainly the surveillance that happens can take very many forms, from the very basic human intelligence, covert surveillance, using a variety of means such as listening devices, concealed microphones, external surveillance such as video cameras, and then to the rather euphemistically entitled wiretaps, which in the UK we described as intercepts. Now, we use those in the UK quite considerably, and their use is largely determined by the nature of what we face in the realms of the number of threats, in as far as what the intercepts evidence allows us to do is understand the foundation of the conspiracies that exist. They inform and uncover networks and conspiracies and are really a way of showing where to direct resources.
Do the rules in Britain differ from those in the United States when it comes to intercepts or wiretaps?
Most definitely. In the UK at present, and this is very much an ongoing debate across the political spectrum, intercepts evidence or the wiretaps can only be used for intelligence purposes. It's very much, and this is a strategy that's used in the UK, it's called an intelligence-led approach. So the wiretaps can only be authorised by the Home Secretary. Once they've actually been issued, it does have judicial oversight. But this intercept evidence, these wiretaps, can then inform the ongoing investigation. But the key point to make is that they're not admissible in open court. They can't actually be used in a criminal prosecution, which is different, obviously, from what happens in the USA at present.
So it's different in the sense that you can't use the evidence gathered to prove something about anybody in court. But what about this issue of oversight? Is that the same or different from what it is in the United States?
The methods, I think, are subtly different. But what I should say is that both the UK and the US do have an oversight that is separate from the actual initial authorization. The area in the UK is being reviewed as we speak. We've had our most senior prosecutor from the government, from the Crown Prosecution Service, actually come out and openly say that he would like to see intercept evidence used. MI5, the security service, have also said they would like to see this wiretap evidence used in open court as part of prosecutions. Because I think the major point to make, and the example of the US has been used, is that if we don't use the wiretap evidence in court, we're actually stripping ourselves of the ability to provide some crucial evidence that may well lead to the prosecution of serious organized crime and perhaps more importantly, terrorists.
Neil Ellis, again at the Royal United Services Institute in Britain. John Schmidt is formerly Associate Attorney General in the Justice Department under the Clinton administration. He's now a partner in a Chicago law firm. John Schmidt, welcome to our program.
Happy to be here.
It is said by the Bush administration that agents here are limited or will be limited if the president's warrantless wiretap procedures aren't approved by the Congress. What's your view about that?
Well, I think Congress should take action to put in place a legal structure in which everyone can have confidence that would allow the current National Security Agency program to go forward and maybe equally importantly, allow for the possibility of modifications or new programs, better ways to use our surveillance capacity. What we have at the moment is controversy. We have some people who say the current program is illegal. I happen to believe it is not, that if it ever gets to a court decision, courts will uphold the president's constitutional authority to do what he did. But there was a judge in Detroit who said she was prepared to enjoin the program. There obviously are people in Congress and elsewhere who have said they think it's illegal. At the same time, they're saying they think it's a good program. So I think what Congress should do is put in place a legal structure that will allow the program to actually be submitted to a court so a court can make a judgment that I think will be consistent with what we've been hearing, and that is that this is a program that's reasonable in light of the nature of the terrorist threat.
If it's already legal, why does Congress have to take any further action?
Well, you could say it's legal. It's controversial. As I say, one district court judge in Detroit said she thinks it's illegal. A court of appeals has enjoined or stayed that decision from taking effect. So at the moment, the program is still operating. But, you know, this is not an area where the national security agency professionals and others who are professionals in the security operations of our government should be put in a position of having to operate without clear legal standards and a clear basis for knowing that what they are doing is in fact lawful. It has to be an inhibiting situation at the moment. If you're at the NSA and you think here's something we should do a little bit differently, maybe we should extend the program from where it is now, you know that any extension of that kind, any change, is going to potentially evoke even more controversy, and your boss is going to be in front of a congressional committee. So I think the reason Congress needs to act is not because, in my view at least, it is currently illegal, but because we have a level of controversy about it and uncertainty about it that is the wrong way to go about conducting the affairs of our government when we're talking about something of this nature.
John Schmidt, a private practice attorney, formerly with the Clinton Justice Department. Lisa Graves also was with the Clinton Justice Department. She's now deputy director at the Center for National Security Studies. That's a civil liberties organization in Washington. Lisa Graves, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on, Warren.
You are one of those who thinks this is illegal. Why do you think it's illegal?
Well, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was passed in 1978 and updated in the Patriot Act in 2001, is very clear that the way to conduct foreign intelligence gathering on these shores is to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and get a warrant. There's also an exception in that law that provides for emergency wiretaps without a warrant, as long as a warrant is sought after the fact, and that's fully consistent with our fundamental Fourth Amendment rights. That law was uncontroversial. It was passed. It was passed many years ago and was updated in the Patriot Act. There was an extensive debate about the Patriot Act and wiretapping last year, only to have Congress realize that the administration had not been forthright with it, had not told them what they were really doing, and had not asked for the authority that they are exercising without legal sanction.
So your concern is that abuses might occur. What abuses do you know of that have occurred?
Well, this is a circumstance in which this surveillance is conducted secretly. Just to be clear about the type of surveillance, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act wiretaps include wiretapping your home, your home phone, your cell phone, your work phone, recording every conversation you have over the course of months or even years. And in this case, these illegal wiretaps have been going on for over 5 years without any judicial oversight, without any check to make sure that the person being wiretapped is someone who actually is conspiring with al-Qaeda. If there is evidence that a person is conspiring with al-Qaeda, a warrant can easily be obtained by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. In fact, over time, over 99.999% of all requests have been granted by that court.
What about specific abuses that you are aware of?
Well, I would say that the law under the Fourth Amendment and in our history is not to just accept a trust me plan from the government. We've seen in other areas where there has been appropriate disclosure through Freedom of Information Act requests that the administration has been misusing joint terrorism task forces. They've been using joint terrorism task force resources that are supposed to be focused on al-Qaeda to monitor and infiltrate groups that disagree with the war in Iraq. People who are vegetarians, people who disagree with environmental policy, those resources have been misused. It's hard to imagine that in this circumstance, without any check, that there's been no abuse of this power. It's an inherently abusive power, which is why Congress put in checks in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Lisa Graves at the National Security Studies Center for National Security Studies. John Schmidt, back to you. If, in fact, the FISA court, the court established by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, has given warrants in 99.999% of the cases when it's been asked to, even after the fact, when there's been an emergency, why does the law need to be changed?
Well, the problem that General Hayden, who was the head of the National Security Agency when this program was put into effect and is now the head of the CIA, has cited is that the way this program operates, it has analysts who are listening to calls abroad who then pick up leads that would lead to calls in this country. And there isn't time to go through the process either of going to court, or the alternative under the current law is to get the Attorney General to make the necessary determination. I used to actually do that occasionally as acting Attorney General when I was at the Justice Department. But that's a process that requires the preparation of the necessary information, presenting that to the Attorney General, or if you're going to go to court, presenting it to the court. This is a program which operates in real time, where an analyst who's listening to calls, which they're allowed to do in Afghanistan or somewhere else in the world, picks up leads, wants to follow them immediately, and there just isn't time to go to court or to get the Attorney General to grant that certification. So this program sets up a basis on which the analysts will make those judgments. It supervises them in what I think everybody who has actually been allowed to see the details of the program has said is a legitimate way, but there isn't time for court approval. Now, what I'm in favor of, and in this I actually agree with what was being said, there should be a judicial oversight of this program. And what the principal piece of legislation that is now before Congress, the bill developed by Arlen Specter, would do is allow the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to approve a program of this nature, approve the basis on which the judgments are being made, approve the monitoring and all the rest of it, so you could get judicial approval without having to come back to the court every time for approval of an individual warrant.
How do you know, though, that the agents then won't be after vegetarians and people who disagree with the war in Iraq or things of that sort?
Well, the Specter bill requires a regular report back to the court. It allows the court to obtain any additional information that it believes is necessary in order to determine that the program is continuing to be operated on a constitutional basis. So I think you'd have an ongoing reporting mechanism. Unless people were prepared to, you know, commit perjury and file false certificates in the court, you'd have a mechanism for knowing that.
So, Lisa Graves, what about this, and particularly the need for speed under these circumstances?
Well, I understand what John is saying in terms of real-time need. The fact of the matter is that the administration has perpetrated quite a myth on the American people, the notion that that agents have to hang up the phone if a terrorist calls the U.S. That's simply not the case. What we're talking about here is when the NSA then directs its focus on particular individuals here in the country, they need to do so with proper authority. And they can easily get that approval from the Attorney General. And it appears in this case that that in essence, the Attorney General, as the president's kind of right-hand man, has ceded authority over this largely to the NSA. It's unclear that he knows of each of the individual wiretaps that's going on or that he's ever been consulted on an individualized basis. And John mentioned the Specter bill. I think that that bill is so hopelessly flawed. It's so at odds with the fundamental Fourth Amendment freedoms we have in this country. That program warrant, that so-called warrant that Senator Specter has proposed, is one that does not require any individualized showing of wrongdoing at any point in the initial stages. And so basically you have a circumstance where you have a blank check to NSA to conduct a program of surveillance without knowing or telling the court who the Americans are who are being wiretapped. And if under I see the music is coming.
The music
but
is
I would
coming.
Just say
Thank you for picking that up.
It's unconstitutional in its form.
We will come back to you and to John Schmidt as well as Neil Ellis. We also have Ron Susskind on the line. We'll continue this conversation after a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Werman Olney back with To the Point. We've just heard two former lawyers for the Clinton Justice Department disagree very strongly about the constitutionality of President Bush's warrantless, so-called warrantless wiretap surveillance program. It does require some court supervision, according to John Smith, illegal or unconstitutional, according to Lisa Graves. Let's now take a look at the, we're not going to resolve that issue on this program, the threat involved, back to Neil Ellis, the Homeland Security expert at the Royal United Services Institute. Once again, the head of MI5 was very specific, as you pointed out, about the number of terrorist plots, 30 of them linked to al-Qaeda in Pakistan, the 1,600 people that are under surveillance by British agents, the 100,000 or so who are thought to be passive sympathizers with the terrorist actions, such as the bombings of the subways in London. Neil Ellis, what about the implications of that for the United States as the two countries cooperate in these efforts? What do you understand American intelligence people are concerned about when it comes to Great Britain?
I think I should firstly start by saying the relationship between the two countries, certainly in the areas of intelligence, the intelligence agencies, is particularly strong and has developed considerably since September 11th, but it's always been a good relationship. However, I think there is an undercurrent now which perceives the UK, because of, as we've described, the vast figures and and the nature of the threat that we faced in the UK, that the UK itself, or certainly elements of the UK, do actually represent some kind of security problem for the US. When that's overlaid on the relationship between the two intelligence agencies, I think naturally you can imagine that, that there will be some difficulties in approach that will then be developing.
What do you mean by a security problem?
Well, if we look at what the Director General of the Security Service, Eliza Manning Buller, was actually saying, that, and we look in terms of the numbers, and we look back to August, which were the failed conspiracies, the bomb plots around Heathrow Airport, and the subsequent activity that went on there with massive security effort at the airports and such like. The planes and other areas were actually transatlantic, so these were planes that were perhaps going to end up in the US. Now, if you put it in that context, this threat is actually originating from the UK. So you can certainly see that the US intelligence agencies would have some concerns about what's happening in the UK.
And what about the same situation pertaining in the United States, where, of course, there are a great many people, presumably, that are at least potentially under surveillance?
Indeed. And I think the point to make is it's a time not for division, but actually for cohesion. And the intelligence agencies on both sides of the Atlantic, but also throughout the world, in the long war or the global war on terror, are facing largely, however it's defined, a common threat, and how actually that's approached and how that we combated it is by greater integration and cooperation rather than any particular finger pointing or concerns over particular countries.
Neil Ellis at the Royal United Services Institute. Ron Suskind is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His most recent book, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Ron Suskind, always good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here, Juan.
A common threat, differently dealt with legally, we are hearing. What about the way it's dealt with in general? Here we have MI5 coming forward, the head of MI5, and being very specific about the number of people that are under surveillance and so on. What do we know about what's going on here in the United States?
Well, we certainly don't have disclosures like that coming forward from folks in the government here. I think what Eliza Manning Buller said sent some shockwaves across the intelligence and law enforcement communities here in America, because the fact is there is quite a bit that at this juncture we're not hearing that maybe we ought to hear in the United States. One of the scenes that got some play, certainly in the 1% Doctrine, is a fascinating one from the fall of 2003. There's a large National Security Council meeting, everyone from the government who's pertinent is there. And the discussion is that the CIA has identified a dozen or so al-Qaeda operational entities, bad actors, coming to the United States, and they've been lost once they crossed our shoreline by the FBI. This comes up in the meeting. Dick Cheney, who's on the big screen, is quite incensed about it and then presses Bob Mueller, saying, my goodness, is this really true?
Bob Mueller, the head of the FBI.
Head of the FBI, and Mueller says, you know, look, it's harder to track people in America than a lot of folks might think. The fact is they haven't committed any crimes, and the bottom line is that we don't know where they are. That's a problem here in the United States, and I think the dysfunctions between some of our intelligence and law enforcement functions here in America are the kind of things, I hate to say it, we're going to be hearing at some commission at some point after a next attack in America. Part of the goal of the 1% Doctrine is to essentially sort of back end that process to try to look now at what our weaknesses are in expectation, frankly, of the threat that's here and coming.
Well, what about how does that concern fit into the argument we've been hearing about the so-called warrantless wiretap program that the president wants Congress to approve?
Well, you know, I think that what both of your guests have been saying about the warrantless wiretap program is that we simply need an appropriate public debate as to where to draw the lines. I think John and Lisa agree on that point. Right now, we have a bit of dysfunction. The administration's position is essentially, if you don't do anything wrong, you've got nothing to worry about if you're an American, A, and B, we don't want anything to crimp or prescribe our ability to act in any way. Folks on the other side, and many of them are Republicans, say, well, it doesn't work that way in our system. We need to have some transparency, some judicial overview and oversight. And the administration essentially says, then you must be a lawyer for the terrorists if that's your position. That's a dysfunctional conversation. The fact is we can have judicial oversight for this sort of program. It may be cumbersome. It may involve a lot of people in the judicial capacity. But it certainly is something that is doable. And it's something that I think folks maybe in the new Congress are going to discuss.
Ron Suskind, again, author of The 1% Doctrine. Lisa Graves, let me go back to you at the Center for National Security Studies, again, former attorney with the Clinton administration. Do you think, particularly given the way Ron Suskind describes the inability of the law enforcement people in this country to follow people, that ultimately the threat is sufficient that there will be surveillance going on, including wiretaps?
Well, I think that there's really no controversy about the notion that people who are conspiring with al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda operatives should be closely monitored and closely targeted. The question is, when you're focusing on people in the United States, what are the terms, what are the circumstances in which you do so? And I think that we have a situation in which we've got some very different approaches between focusing on those suspects, people who we believe are trying to do us harm, versus this drift net approach of what we've seen reported in terms of the ability of the administration to just tap into our communications infrastructure without focusing on particular individuals and without showing any cause to any court ever. I'm certainly hopeful that in the new Congress, a Congress that isn't bound by partisan loyalty to the president, that members of Congress will get answers to those questions. Members who have heard answers to some questions believe that the program can be subjected to individualized judicial review with some additional resources, as Ron pointed out, I think, and that there's no reason to proceed in this lawless program-wide approach that's been advocated by the administration. I think that Congress now has an opportunity to actually get some answers to questions and make some legislation, some legislative oversight based on being informed about what's really going on with documentary evidence, not just rhetoric from the administration, from Gonzalez, and from others.
John Schmidt, back to you, also formerly with the Clinton Justice Department. Do you think that that would be healthy? Is it time for the Congress and the public to hear more about what's going on?
I am a little skeptical that there is a lot more that can be talked about publicly. I do think we should put in place a mechanism that would allow a court to be fully informed, and I think realistically the only court that can be fully informed is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, because you cannot spell out in an open court proceeding details of surveillance of this kind. You know, we have to hope that there are things being done that we really don't know about and that we could not fully anticipate, because we want terrorists to be in a position of not knowing exactly what we're going to be doing. So I think you can only do so much in a public forum, but I do think you can create a mechanism to give everybody a level of comfort that a court has reviewed the program and has concluded that it is constitutional.
Well, should we know at least the kinds of things that MI5 has revealed in Britain, the number of people under surveillance, the number of plots that might be linked to Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, and should the public better understand the threat?
Well, I think that it's a tactical judgment for the intelligence professionals in terms of what can or cannot be told. There may be reasons, there was speculation, there may have been some political reasons for MI5 to make that particular statement, but I'm not talking really about that level of generalized statement. I think that can be done, but I don't think you can spell out in detail the way a surveillance program is working either in an open congressional hearing or beyond that to the public at large. I do think, however, you can create a mechanism so a court can understand it. I'm not a particular supporter of President Bush. I'm a Democrat, but he has said he's prepared to submit this program to a court, and the fundamental thing that the Specter bill would do would be to give the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court the jurisdiction to allow it to review the program, which it doesn't have now. So, I'm optimistic, that if we can get beyond some of the partisanship, I can't see why anyone would be against that. And it seems to me if the president's willing to do that, it ought to be possible to create a legal structure to allow that.
All right. Lisa Graves, of course, is saying this is not just a question of partisanship, but a question of legality as well. Ron Suskind, let me go back to you, our journalist, author of The 1% Doctrine. What is the consequence, do you think, of politicizing this debate? It's one thing to have, as you suggested, an open and clear and honest debate about it in Congress, but the more partisan it becomes, how does that then make the program itself and the effort to deal with this issue more dysfunctional, to use your word?
Yeah, the fact, Warren, is one of the great challenges of this year is whether our democratic process can be nimble enough, flexible enough, to deal with some of these very thorny issues to fight this new kind of war. And the fact is the reviews at this point are not very good. You get a dug-in position on either side, bunker to bunker, and what you have is very little common sense. Look, the fact is I'll personalize this issue. There are many reporters I know who have been on the phone from time to time with folks in the jihadist community, as a reporter will, folks who clearly are on an NSA phone tree. Does that mean that that reporter now is on that NSA phone tree? And does that mean that reporter's sources are now on that NSA phone tree? If you're doing this sort of drift net, that's a question that it is rightful and appropriate to be asking, and that none of us can get answers to. That's what happens when you have a program that essentially is not fitted at this juncture into the legal structure of the United States. It has to change, period.
Is this an issue simply because you're describing something that it's possible to do, so necessarily it's going to be done?
Well, the fact is, in the war on terror, and I think this is understandable, I spent a lot of time with the folks I call the invisibles, the people involved in the 24/7 fight. Anything that's possible will be tried. It's a matter of improvisational urgency. It still grips many of the folks in the fight, and they will do anything they can do unless they're told they can't do it. And the fact is, at this point, there are many people who have been swept up all over the planet, certainly, and here in the United States, in these vast sort of surveillance sweeps. Questions they ask is there a time in which maybe if I'm spit out, that I am fully spit out, that I'm not forever in it, or that there's not forever access to my phone lines? This is why you need judicial oversight and some transparency in the system. There's nobody who wants to give away sources and methods or tell our enemies anything that they need to hear. Having said that, the fact is that we're dealing with some dysfunction as well, based on the belief that we can't have anything made public. That's simply wrong. The model should be anything that the terrorists know or have known for some time should be part of what the public is entitled to know. That's the way you should be drawing that line, and right now we need to draw those lines in all of these areas.
John Schmidt, let me go back to you, especially when we see again and again people getting on the no-fly list who appear not to deserve to be there and who can't get off, even though it's well known that they're on it for the wrong reasons. Doesn't the public have the right to know, then, the kinds of information Ron Suskind's talking about?
Well, I think the public has a right to understand generally how information is being collected and how it's being used. But I guess I would come back to the fact that the actual details of programs like this, which I think may be where the real constitutional issues come. They don't lie at some generalized level. They come down to, are judgments being made on an appropriate standard? Are the people who are making those judgments being appropriately monitored? Is there an appropriate mechanism to make sure this information is only used for the permissible purposes of intelligence and not for other purposes? And I think that becomes a quite detailed, particularized kind of judgment that I think a court can make in a confidential setting. But I, as much as you want to say, well, the public should know things, I think that there are limits to what the public can know about the details of how a program like that operates. And to rely on either congressional oversight or general public awareness as the appropriate constraint, I think is a mistake. I think we need a court to give people comfort that this program or any other program, as I say, I think an important element here is this program is not the end of the world or end of the word in terms of what we should be doing. We may need a different program tomorrow. And it seems to me we have a climate at the moment which has to make it very difficult for security professionals to make intelligent judgments and make confident judgments about how we should be using our surveillance capacity.
So, Lisa Graves, can't we rely on the courts?
Well, I would say that this has to be a process in which there are checks both in Congress and the courts, and the courts process has been consistent with our Fourth Amendment rights, an individualized check. And the fact of the matter is that if the president wanted to get a judicial check on this program, he could do it right now. He could submit any one of these wiretaps if someone he claims is conspiring with al-Qaeda to the FISA court and ask for its approval. He could do that tomorrow. Instead, he sought to fight every single lawsuit in the country and try to get those lawsuits kicked out of court. He has refused to submit those wiretaps, perhaps thousands and thousands of them, going on for years and years since September 11th and more perhaps every day, to any judicial oversight, any facts showing that they have someone who actually is conspiring with al-Qaeda or is al-Qaeda in their scope. They have thwarted oversight by Congress. They failed to abide by the National Security Act of 1947, which requires disclosure to Congress in secret session in the foreign intelligence, in the intelligence agencies of this information on a committee-wide basis. They have thwarted every check in place in the law. And unless this new Congress stands up to the president, it will continue. The president will continue to do so.
Ron Susskind, obviously, this debate is going to go on. Whether it's or how public it's going to be, and what we know is yet to be determined. But based on your researches and your sources and your understanding, and putting together the 1% doctrine deep inside America's pursuit of its enemies since 9/11, what do you think of the prospects of the United States being attacked again by Al Qaeda?
Well, I'm in the camp that believes that Al Qaeda, or its spores, its franchisees, can attack the United States at a time and place of their choosing. The way we understand it works is that these self-activated cells, which are often self-supporting, tend to check in on high when they reach their operational moment. Up to now, there have been several instances, including one in the 1% doctrine, where bin Laden, Zawahiri have called them off. I think the smartest thinking now from the folks who know the most, is that al-Qaeda will attack the United States when it is a time of strategic sense, good sense for them. Right now, oddly, the United States seems to be doing so much to undermine its own case in the world, to build anti-Americanism, recruitment, to essentially blow off one toe after another, that the thinking is this is not a time where al-Qaeda will feel is a good time to attack the United States. The twist of this, if we start developing a more coherent foreign policy where the left hand of Iraq is not undermining the right hand of the broader war on terror, actually then al-Qaeda might be activated to attack the United States, which of course would build sympathy for us and unite our allies. Those are things they don't want unless they feel they need to do it. The general thinking, again, is that the next attack should be bigger, at least in terms of their playbook, bigger and more destructive, if you will, than 9/11, to create an upward arc of terror and anticipation between that second attack and whatever follows. Terror is what they're about. So I'm not feeling any comfort from the fact that we've gone these years without a follow-up to 9/11. And I think most of the folks in the terrorist community in the United States, at CIA, at FBI, agree with this position, which is why many of them actually are quite concerned right now You know, the thing that we're not talking about is that signal intelligence, the wiretapping, you know, is a part of the equation. I think, frankly, it's a bit overrated. It's a little like human intelligence without context. It's the human intelligence that ultimately saves us when you're especially fighting a low-grade insurgency. That human intelligence has withered for the United States since the Iraq War has flowered and built anti-Americanism and anti-American sentiments around the world. Our friends, you know, and certainly our reluctant friends around the world, are not being as helpful as they were. That makes us blind, especially with this metastasized franchisee model of our enemy, when we need vision. And that's a point of real concern.
That is the subject for another program. We will conduct it in the near future. Ron Suskind, thank you very much for being with us. Again, the book, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Thanks to Lisa Graves at the Center for National Security Studies, John Schmidt, private attorney, both formerly with the Clinton administration, and Neil Ellis in Britain, where he is a homeland security expert at the Royal United Services Institute. CNN and the BBC now have a new rival for international news on English-language television. Al Jazeera has become vastly influential in the Arabic-speaking world. Will its frankness and its willingness to discuss taboo issues win a new audience? More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Al Jazeera's greatest achievement has been to end the monopolies on news held by governments in the Middle East. It's won viewers with reports that have angered those same governments as well as those in the Western world. Al Jazeera Now will be available in English. Jonathan Curiel is a staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, wrote about this today. Jonathan, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I should point out at first that right at the moment, this television service will not be available on cable channels in the United States. How can Americans get it?
You can get it by subscribing to Globecast, which is a satellite network. But more easily than that, you can get it on the Internet and watch it on your computer at two Internet TV networks. One of them is called VDC, which is how I got access this morning to watch Al Jazeera. I've been watching it for the last hour.
What's it been broadcasting?
It's been broadcasting interviews, exclusive interviews with world leaders from around the world. And when I tuned in this morning, the first thing I saw was an interview that Riz Khan, formerly of CNN, was doing with Shimon Peres, and he was asking Peres about Iran, about you know, the attacks, rocket attacks that have been happening in Israel, and it was an exclusive interview. Now Shimon Peres talks to a lot of people, but you know, for Al Jazeera to get Shimon Peres, you know, a high-ranking Israeli official right away on its initial broadcast is a bit of a coup.
You mentioned a former CNN journalist as conducting that interview. Will there be other non-Arab journalists on this English-speaking version of Al Jazeera?
Well, there will be many, and so some of whom will be recognizable for people who watch TV, and that is, for example, Dave Marish, formerly of ABC News Nightline. He's the chief Washington anchor for Al Jazeera. And you mentioned Riz Khan already. For those who are fans of the BBC, it seems like half the staff of Al Jazeera's international staff are BBC alums, including, for example, Rage Omar, formerly for the BBC. He's in Tehran right now for Al Jazeera, which again is a bit of a coup. I mean, I think people have read recently that Iran has not granted Western journalists much access to the country. Now Al Jazeera has someone there. I don't know if he's going to be full time there, but he's there right now.
Why does it appear that none of the cable channels in the United States, cable services, has picked it up yet?
Well, that's a good question. That's a question I had wanted to ask Al Jazeera's top people. I didn't get interviews with the top people. I got interviews with some staffers, and it seems that you know that there may be, you reading between the lines, there may be some concern among these cable outlets about actually having Al Jazeera. Now I don't have that confirmed. I didn't talk to any cable outlets for the story, but that's the scuttlebutt anyway.
There are people who say that Al Jazeera is anti-American.
Well, yeah, there are people like that, including Cliff Kincaid with the Accuracy in Media watchdog group in Washington. Now, Al Jazeera's people will say that most people who complain about it have actually never watched it. One of the things I asked Cliff Kincaid was whether he had watched it, and he said no. He has based his concerns on clips that U.S. networks have run from Al Jazeera, and I think it's fair to say that is true for a lot of people, that they voice their concern out of something that they know very little about. If you actually watch Al Jazeera in Arabic, which you can actually do, you can watch segments of it on the Mosaic satellite channel, which also has an internet presence. But if you watch Al Jazeera, yes, you know, they do show the human drama that is happening in the Arab and Muslim world. But they also run interviews with Israeli officials, and they run interviews with American officials. You know, I talked to the Washington bureau chief. They've been trying to get an interview with Rumsfeld. Now he's been a vital critic of Al Jazeera, but they didn't get the interview. It's not for lack of trying.
They have, in fact, interviewed Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, have they not?
I believe that's true. I believe that's true. And there was this concern. I know Karen Hughes is in this position with official position of trying to reach out to Arab and Muslim world. But and she has gone in Al Jazeera, I believe, and so have other State Department officials. But again, you know, Al Jazeera doesn't show a completely one-sided view of the world. They do cover the U.S. the way a lot of legitimate U.S. news organizations do. And from what I can tell, watching just about an hour of it so far, their new English channel, they're going to do a good job of covering Washington. Now, they're not going to stress a lot of Washington insider stuff. Their lead story from Washington Desk was a story on Brazil, on these landless Indians there who are trying to get more land. And so that's an example of how their reporting will be different from, say, the BBC and CNN.
Got about 10 seconds left. How much bigger will Al Jazeera's audience or potential audience be when it goes English?
Well, their Arab audience now is 40 million. They're hoping in households. They're available now, in they say, in 80 million households. Now, how many people watch that? That's a big question. They want 40 million people to be watching it regularly.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Curiel, San Francisco Chronicle staff writer. Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Vanessa Romo and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Phoebe Zimmerman. You can listen online anytime at kcrw.com. Click on News. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.